There are times when I look at discourse and think, are we really having this conversation? You know, as we speak, Palestine is under assault. So many public intellectuals are afraid to say anything. And I understand why. I think the fear is legitimate. That is perplexing to me. That is perplexing. When you see a situation where, yes, there is a loss of life on both sides, and where it's so fragile that in some instances, people demonstrating solidarity with Palestine allows them the forum to air their anti-Semitism. And so you have to be very cautious about that, because no, this is not a free for all. This is instead saying that you cannot have state sanctioned apartheid and consider it to be okay. Like, we have to be able, and I, this is not my area of expertise, and so I always defer to the experts, but at the same time, surely we can say that this loss of life that is happening right now is staggering.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hey everyone, I'm Tricia Rose. Welcome to The Tightrope. This is a special brief edition conversation with my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Cornel West. We wanted to just take a few minutes to reflect on the 1 year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd, because we think it's important to remember this profound experience for the country, for the world, and the loss, of course, of his life, and to sort of check in about what this means at the 1 year mark, where we are today and, you know, where we want to go. So I just want to bring in my dear and brilliant friend, Cornel. Cornel, what are you thinking about where we are right now, 1 year since George Floyd was murdered in the street in Minneapolis? What's on your mind about this, and what should we be thinking?
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. And you know, it's always a joy to be thinking with you critically about these issues. In my mind, the public lynching of Brother George Perry Floyd Jr. was a catalyst for the unprecedented social motion in the streets, in the American Empire, and in every corner of the globe. So it went beyond even the catalytic power of Emmett Till in August of 1955. Who would have thought that there would be an event that would go even beyond Emmett Till? But I think the public lynching of Floyd does. And that was a beautiful thing to behold. I think we should not in any way downplay that, though, Sister Tricia.
Right.
That kind of multiracial solidarity in the United States and around the world was crucial. I think that kind of pressure had much to bear with sending the policeman, Brother Derek, sending that gangster to jail.
Right.
That's very, very rare in the history of U.S. policing that you actually have a guilty conviction and they actually end up going to jail. Now, on the other hand, you got, you know, Sister Brianna and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of others who are still waiting for justice. Justice denied is justice delayed. But even in addition to that, you know, when you have a U.S. president like Joe Biden, when you have a U.S. vice president like Sister Harris, Kamala Harris, saying explicitly that the United States is not a racist country, then you wonder what kind of real concrete effect has the social motion and movement responding to Floyd's lynching actually had in the higher echelons of the political class of the country. Mm-hmm. It's affected the consciousness in a massive way.
Right.
But you can get Clyburn, you can get all the other black echoes of Biden sitting up there on national television saying America is not a racist country.
Right.
Now, whether they believe it or not, they're still saying it, you think.
Right, right, right.
And so
that
to me is disturbing.
Yeah, you know, that's disturbing. But, you know, I feel like the question is designed to put us on the defensive. That is to say, if you say we're a racist country, now you trigger that kind of knee-jerk rage and anxiety that many whites feel that they're being personally, morally criticized. And that kind of personalization of racism and the refusal to examine the system and the country as a whole, right? People identify with the country in ways I personally can't fathom. So that identification is what they're resisting. And I think so the question forces a polarization. If you say they're racist, then there's nothing good about America and you're a hater and now you got to fight all that foolishness. So, you know, who wants to go down that fruitless road, you know?
Melville used to say truth uncompromisingly told always has its ragged edges.
Whoa.
And so you just let the white folks say, oh, he must be saying I'm a racist. Yes. Yeah, that's in part what he's saying. You know what
Touché.
I mean?
Touche.
That's right. Touche.
I'll give you that. But Cornell, if we want to say, okay, look, think of it strategically, right?
Right.
If we say, look, racism is a profound and fundamental part of the American project.
That's right.
Right. To say that is different than to say America is racist. Who is America? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, is it the state? Is it the citizenry? See, to me, it's so vague and so general that it actually doesn't do us a service ultimately. But let me just say, go ahead. Flip side of it, though,
Sister Tricia, that Biden steps up like every U.S. president we know and says that the American people are fundamentally a good people. Mm-hmm. I said, he willing to say that. Now, how are they going to be good with slavery, lynching, mass incarceration, greed? You know what I mean? But they can say that and get away with it. But when you ask them to tell the truth about, is it a racist country? Well, of course it's a racist country. But if you want to be a fighter against racism, whatever color you are, you join the club. If you're already a member of the club, it don't affect you. Because you know what you're fighting against. You see what I mean? So that you can see how people can exaggerate on one side. Talk about how wonderful the place is.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's myth-making and identity connection, right? I mean, we know. But if you're right, this is a good point you're making. I mean, Cornell, you got me. But I got an answer for you, bro. I got something for you.
You got some powerful insights and points in
that. So look, if what you said is true, that this was a watershed moment, that the George Floyd murder and the particular characteristics of it, the video footage of it, the timing of the pandemic, all the legacy of activism and the hard soil turning work that Black Lives Matter and other groups have done, put us in a position to make a huge push to make some real major changes, right, that have been successful in some ways. I'm not saying we've, you know, won this war, but we've won more battles recently than we've won in a very long time.
Absolutely.
So if that's true, then, you know, should we not be careful about allowing ourselves to be baited into an intellectual debate where we feel we have to speak the truth intellectually, but lose the battle on the ground because the question has been framed in such a way to trigger what we already know is going to be the answer of many liberal whites, conservative whites who haven't really thought through questions of race adequately. So to me, it's not about denying it or accepting it, but about being strategic. So now Biden, that's another question. But the question is, when we start answering those questions, right, I want to say to you, okay, Cornell, remember now critical race theory and the study of systemic racism is 5 minutes from being outlawed in a number of states in the country. So we're not talking about just the people who are not comfortable thinking about America as racist as an intellectual project. We're talking about people saying, we're not going to allow our children to even know about this history.
That feels more profound
as a problem than getting all caught up in this question.
No, it's true. But the very fact that we have to be so sensitive with these strategic considerations.
Yes.
Shows how deep white supremacy operates.
Without a doubt. But were we confused about that before the question got asked?
Yeah, that's true too. No, that's a powerful point.
I mean, I wasn't that's confused about
no,
that.
No, I hear you. Absolutely. No, I hear you. I mean, part of it has to do with going back to your crucial insight about how you frame it. You see, all they had to say, for example, when they raise that kind of question, you're going to say, I've already given talks on how systemic racism operated. I've always given talks on how white supremacy was a fundamental foundation for the country in relation to slavery.
Right.
And I give Biden credit. You know, he's the first president out of 40-some presidents to even talk about white supremacy in public. Can you imagine
that? That's a pretty nice hurdle. You imagine how far that is.
And how out of touch all the other presidents have been.
Oh, yeah. No, there was no room for that.
You can't talk about white supremacy, and that's the foundation of your country. You say, well,
I know.
God almighty. Right. Here's a moral prize for making a breakthrough. We appreciate that. You know what I mean?
Right.
But the way you formulated it about, okay, we still the centrality of systematic racism and so forth, so the folk won't get you in a corner rhetorically and strategically, but you still know how deep it the racism
this
cuts.
It's a fundamental pillar of the American project. It's not all we are.
That's
it's
right.
not all everybody is, but it is a fundamental pillar. You can't make sense of America without addressing it.
That's all he had to say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but you know, it's a battlefield out there in the political world, you know, in terms of just the capacity to turn on a dime, right? This movement. And there's the white backlash about the discussions of systemic racism is a very big deal. You're seeing it in independent schools where these wealthy schools are trying to address these issues in the curriculum because they have more control over their curriculum than our public schools do, for example. And there are lots of outraged parents, and there are all these laws. In Rhode Island, I believe there's an educational law. Little old Rhode Island's all up in arms about, you know, we don't want white guilt. We don't want to be blamed. And they're on a warpath. I think that is a worthwhile piece of the reason why, not just cowardice, although that may be a part, but the sense of like, look, we don't want to lose this momentum that George Floyd has, you know, allowed us to capitalize on.
No, it's true. It's true. But it's hard to have strong momentum if you're afraid of speaking the truth. It's hard to sustain it because, for example, I mean, one of the reasons why Biden and Harris would say what they say is because it allows a whole lot of vanilla brothers and sisters to say, well, with a black president and a black vice president, how could we even have a racist country?
Oh, yeah.
So
people
they
be saying that.
But then you also got the black backlash, because the black backlash in a way doesn't receive as much attention, too, which is to say, when you then have black leaders like Clyburn and Harris and others go into the black community and say, but you said we're not a racist country. Now, how in the world are you going to speak to our situation if you can't even speak the truth publicly? And the truth is that if Biden had said America is a racist country, Harris would say America's a racist country because she's an echo of him.
She's the vice president.
They'd just be following the president. So which means none of them really concerned about the truth. You say, come on, Kamala. You just saying whatever Biden's saying. Come on, Clyburn. You just going with the Democratic Party leadership. What is the truth?
Yeah, but are you really looking for the truth from, you know, this level of corporate run politics?
Well, you got to both have what you and I are wrestling with, which is a strategic way of talking and engaging the truth.
Right.
But once you get into the habit of not telling the truth,
you got a point.
Then
you can't compromise on that.
It's true. It's hard to sustain it. It's like the critiques of Obama. If you don't have a critique of Obama, you're going to end up rationalizing some mess.
Right. But
and your
but
criticism
is
going to be weak when you do get criticism because you haven't had criticism. You haven't exercised it in a while. And that's true for anything.
That's true. No, I'm with you, Cornell. And I think there's two sides to this problem. One is not telling the truth enough in order to be comfortable. You start stuttering. You got no facts. You can't get yourself together because you ain't been saying nothing for a long time. And then the other side is you get caught up in a kind of, I'm going to speak the truth regardless of the strategic significance of what happens. And you blow it up. And now folks are still dying, still hungry, still in jail. That's all because you had to tell this 100% truth in the wrong setting at the wrong time. So
that's right. That's
for
right.
me, we you know, it's, to have some kind of reflection that is balanced about those things that that's does right. not step away from the truth. No, I'm with you on that.
Keep in mind, you see, that your very complicated interplay between fundamentally being committed to truth, but recognizing there's a strategic dimension to it, and there is an uncompromising dimension to it, that for me is just a commitment to the truth about how we tell the truth.
Right. Right, exactly.
So it's still a commitment to the truth.
Yeah. No, I'm with that. I think we have to be able to tell the truth, but it's very important. I mean, the level of you know, you're really right. I mean, shorthand is you right.
Because strategic effects are truths that flow from telling the truth. You tell the truth in such a way that you have no regard for strategic effects. You're not really open to the truth about the truth.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Or the truth about the truth telling. The truth about the effects of the truth telling. You know what I mean? No, it's
I know exactly what you mean. Right. And that's you know, to me, why it's so important. If they had said, is America, you know, is there structural racism in America? Does structural racism define America's, you know, day-to-day life? That's a different question.
That's a different
question. When you make a country, a subject, a human entity, a racist, the country cannot be racist. It's a country. It's not a person, right? But so people get identified. It's a formulation that is designed to encourage people to identify with the country, who wave that flag. You know, I'm not that type of person, but that may, you know, many millions of Americans are. And then to have them feel that their patriotism is being attacked and their ignorance about what constitutes the formations of racism, the foundation of the country, it falls away. They're not interested in learning about that. They're just in defense mode. So the question, you know, prevents the conversation that we're trying to have.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, but again, we got these politicians. They're just locked into the positive mode. America's a kind nation. Like a kind person. Oh, everybody can say that. America's a nice, sweet nation. A gentle
Lord
nation.
Lord have mercy. I know.
Quit lying. It ain't a kind nation.
I mean, what country would be?
In certain contexts. You got kind individuals in the nation, but it ain't a kind nation. You know what I mean?
Right. But what is a kind nation? I mean, where is that in the old way?
It does not exist. It's
exactly.
A
so
oxymoron. It's
that's actually
a
another way to end
it. Unicorn.
Oh, that's a good one. But I mean, Cornell, if you think about it, that's really the answer to the question. You say, is America racist? Say, man, look, the whole world's got, you know, hate and oppression. All countries in the world. We're not exceptional. We do not. We didn't fall from a separate tree.
That's exactly. And you can imagine in my own little, you know, parochial Christian discourse, the very notion of a kind nation is about as contradictory as talking about how, you know, how sweet.
A kind oligarchy.
Exactly. I mean, you know,
a generous oligarchy.
It doesn't exist. There's people, there's kind people, there's kind ways of being in the world, but it's not a kind nation. No such thing.
Right. Right. I mean, they could have been, look, we struggle with a profound legacy where we did not live up to all of our ideals all of the time. We left a lot of people behind. We harmed a lot of people and we have some work to do, but we have value systems and beliefs that will help us on this journey.
Help us fight it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's all I need to say.
But you know,
that's
Biden is a little past the point where he can freestyle that kind of analysis.
Oh, you ain't lying.
You know, we got to keep him on point. We got to keep him.
But Sister Kamala could do it. She's brilliant. She's poised.
True that.
She's just an echo. She says she wants to be in the room with the president and have the last word. Was that the last word in the room, that America is not a racist country? Come on, sister.
I know. Well, you be holding people. I'd be letting people go. I'd be letting like, well, I understand what happened in there. You're like, nope, I'm about to knock on this door and tell them truth is right outside waiting for you when you get out of this conversation.
You tell the folk in North Carolina and Elizabeth City about Andrew Brown getting shot in the back by the police, and these folk rationalized it and justified it. That is as racist and white supremacists you can get.
Right. And it's happening probably while we're speaking. You know, I was going to say when we started about, you know, this conversation about George Floyd, you know, in addition to all of the, you know, profound outpouring and multiracial, multi-class, you know, activism and support that came out of it, you know, the actual trial results, you know, the serendipity context, circumstances that had to be in play for this rare occurrence to happen. That's I just want to remind people, if Keith Ellison was not the attorney general, if the city decided to file charges, none of this would have happened. It wasn't that it was because the footage was so good. It had nothing to do with any of that. And I think that's a hard truth that we have to be, I think, really take a really close look at.
And if Sister Darnella had not been courageous and visionary, keeping her phone on the lynching.
But they could have arrested her as they did the gentleman who tried to take the video of Eric Garner.
Absolutely.
So, you know, had those other cops arrested her, we might not have had that footage any old way.
That's exactly right.
So there's all of this serendipity. Right. People like, oh, finally,
the justice system y'all better. Works. We've got to restore our confidence in the fairness of the system. Spare me one.
Out of millions.
All of those ifs.
Right, exactly. I know it's a shocking situation, but you know, look, you turn the circumstances that are in front of you into something that you can use, right? That spirit of creation of the make the beauty of the making do, the beauty of the taking what you have around you, that is, you know, whether it's debris, whether it's leftover, whether it's designed for other purposes, you put it in a new way, you refashion it, build a quilt, whatever the, you know, a collage out of this circumstance and try to keep making something better out of it. So that spirit has been a very important political, social, you know, cultural spirit that I think we just got to keep hoping for as much as possible as we move forward and hope we don't lose any more people.
Well, you have just eloquently laid bare the history of a people right there. Working with what we got and using what we have in light of a grand vision against adverse circumstances. That's exactly right.
Try to turn it around, you know.
To turn it around.
So we're gonna keep sewing patches together, Cornell. We're gonna keep whatever fragments, they're gonna turn it into something else.
That's it.
Well, it's so good to hear you, and thanks. I'm glad you pushed me on my, you know, on my position there. That was helpful. I'm gonna go home and think about it.
Always rich, Sister Trisha.
Always. Thank you, Cornell. It's been a joy. Well, thanks everyone for joining us here. You know, we hope you'll join us on Patreon. We're going to be heading over there in a couple few days. And, you know, please tell your friends to be a part of our Patreon community. So join us at www.patreon.com/thetightropepod. All right, everybody. Have a good day. Take care now.